tubes. Some talked with each other by shouting, and others just stared at the walls. At mid-morning, Jerry Jacks was working in room C. He decided to take a break to rest and check up on his people. He left the room in charge of Sergeants Amon and Clagus, while he went out into the hallway. Suddenly, there was a commotion in room C, and the monkeys in that room burst out in wild screeches. Jerry ran back to the room, where he found the sergeants outside the door, looking in a state of alarm. "What happened?" "A monkey escaped, sir." "Ah, shit!" Jax roared. The animal had bolted past Sergeant Amon as he opened the cage, and the sergeants had immediately run out of the room and shut the door behind them. A loose monkey. This was what Jerry had feared the most. They can leap long distances. He'd been bitten by monkeys himself, and he knew what that felt like. Those teeth went in deep. They looked into the room through the window and the door. The whole room had exploded in activity, monkeys whirling in their cages and shaking them violently, giving off high, excited whoops. There were about 100 screaming monkeys in that room. But where was the loose monkey? They couldn't see it. They found a catching net, a pole with a bag-like net at the end. They opened the door and edged into the room. The events that followed have a dreamlike quality in people's memories, and the memories are contradictory. Specialist Rhonda Williams has a clear memory that the monkey escaped from the room. She says she was sitting on a chair when it happened, that she heard a lot of shouting, and suddenly the animal appeared and ran under her feet. She froze in terror and then burst out laughing, nervous, near hysterical laughter. The animal was a small, determined male, and he wasn't going to let these people get near him with a net. Jerry Jacks insists that the monkey never got out of the room. It's possible that the monkey ran under Specialist Williams's feet and then was chased back into the room again. The loose monkey was very frightened, and the soldiers were very frightened. He stayed in the room for a while, running back and forth across the cages. The other monkeys apparently grew angry at this and bit at the monkey's toes. The monkey's feet began to bleed, and pretty soon it had tracked blood all over the room. Jerry got on the radio and reported that a monkey was loose and bleeding. Gene Johnson told him to do whatever had to be done. How about shooting the monkey? Bring in a handgun, like an Army 45. Jerry didn't like that idea. Looking into the room, he noticed that the loose monkey was spending most of its time hiding behind the cages. If you tried to shoot the monkey, you'd be firing into the cages, and the bullet could hit a cage or a wall and might ricochet inside the room. Getting a gunshot wound was bad enough under any circumstances, but even a mild wound in this building might be fatal. He decided that the safest procedure would be to go into the room and capture the monkey with the net. He took Sergeant Amon with him. As they entered the room, they couldn't see the monkey. Jerry proceeded forward slowly, holding the net up, ready to swipe it at the monkey. But where was it? He couldn't see very well. His faceplate was covered with sweat, and the light was dim in the room. He might as well have been swimming underwater. He edged slowly forward, keeping his body away from the cages on either side, which were filled with hysterical, screaming, leaping, bar-rattling monkeys. The sound of monkeys raising hell was deafening. He was afraid of being bitten by a monkey if he came too close to a cage, so he stayed in the middle of the room as he went forward, while Sergeant Amon followed him, holding a syringe full of drugs on a pole. "Be careful, Sergeant," he said. "Don't get bitten. Stay back from the cages." He edged his way from cage to cage, looking into each one, trying to see through it toward the shadowy wall behind. Suddenly he saw a flicker of movement out of the corner of his eye. and he turned with the net, and the monkey went soaring through the air over him, making a 12-foot jump from one side of the room to the other. "Get him! He's over here," he said. He waved the net, slammed it around over the cages, but the monkey was gone. He walked through the room again, slowly. The monkey leaped across the room, a huge, tail-swinging leap. The animal was airborne whenever it moved. Jerry waved his net and missed. "Son of a bitch!" he shouted. The monkey was too fast for him. He would spend 10 or 15 minutes searching the room, squinting past the cages. If he found the monkey would leap to the other side of the room. It was a small monkey, built for life in the trees. He thought, "This environment favors the monkey over us. We don't have the tools to handle this situation. We're not in control here. We're along for the ride." Outside the building, Colonel C.J. Peters stopped by to observe the operation. He was dressed in Levi's and a sweater, along with sandals and socks, even though it was a cold day. With his sandals and mustache, he appeared to be a 60s type, or some sort of a low-grade employee, maybe a janitor. He noticed a stranger hanging around the front of the building. Who was this? Then the man started to come around the side of the building. He was obviously after something, and he was getting too close to the action. CJ hurried forward and stopped the man, and asked him what he was doing. He was a reporter from the Washington Post. "What's happening around here?" he asked CJ.
Well, nothing much is happening," CJ replied.
He was suddenly very glad he hadn't worn his colonel's uniform today. For once, his bad habits had paid off. He didn't encourage the reporter to come around to the side of the building and have a look in through the window. The reporter left shortly afterward, having seen and heard nothing of interest. The Washington Post suspected that something funny was happening at the monkey house, but the reporters and editors who worked on the story couldn't quite get to the bottom of it. "This monkey knows nets," Jerry shouted to the sergeant. The monkey wasn't going to let himself be caught by some fool of a human wearing a plastic bag. They decided to leave him in the room overnight. Meanwhile, the surviving monkeys were becoming increasingly agitated. The teams killed most of the monkeys this day, working straight through until after dark. Some of the soldiers began to complain that they weren't being given enough responsibility, and so Jerry let them take over more of the hazardous work from the officers. He assigned Specialist Rhonda Williams to duty at the euthanasia table with Major Nate Powell. The major laid a drugged monkey on the table, holding its arms behind its back in case it woke up, while Rhonda uncapped a syringe and gave the monkey a heart stick, plunged the needle into the chest between the ribs, aiming for the heart. She pushed the plunger, sending a load of drugs into the heart, which killed the monkey instantly. She pulled the needle out, and a lot of blood squirted out of the puncture wound. That was a good sign. It meant she'd punctured the heart. If she got blood on her gloves, she rinsed them in a pan of bleach, and if she got blood on her spacesuit, she wiped it down with a sponge soaked in bleach. It was awful when she missed the heart. She pushed the plunger, the poison flooded the animal's chest around the heart, and the monkey jumped. It doubled up, its eyes moved, and it seemed to struggle. This was only a death reflex, but she gasped, and her own heart jumped. Then Colonel Jax put her to work at the bleed table with Captain Haynes, and presently she began drawing blood from unconscious monkeys. She inserted the needle into the animal's leg vein and drew the blood. Their eyes were open. She didn't like that. She felt they were staring at her. She was bleeding a monkey when suddenly she thought its eyes moved, and it seemed to be trying to sit up. It was awake. It looked at her in a daze and reached out and grabbed her by the hand, the one that was holding the syringe. The monkey was very strong. The needle came out of its thigh and blood spurted out. Then the animal started pulling her hand toward its mouth, It was trying to bite her hand. She screamed, "Grab him! Somebody, please! He's getting up!" Captain Haynes caught the monkey's arms and pinned it to the table, shouting, "We have one that's awake! We need ketamine!" The needle, in coming out of the monkey, had cut the monkey's leg vein. Immediately, a ball of blood the size of a baseball formed in the monkey's leg. It just got bigger and bigger, the blood pouring under the skin, and Rhonda almost burst into tears. She pressed her hands on the blood ball to stop the internal bleeding. Through her gloves, she could feel the blood swelling. A ball of Ebola blood. A soldier hurried over and hit the monkey with a double load of ketamine, and the monkey went limp. During the crisis, Peter Yarling spent every day wearing a spacesuit in his lab, running tests on monkey samples, trying to determine where and how the virus was spreading, and trying to get a pure sample of the virus isolated. Meanwhile, Tom Geisbert pulled all-nighters, staring at the cellscapes through his microscope. Occasionally, they met each other in an office and closed the door. "How are you feeling?" "Tired, but otherwise I'm okay." "No headaches?" "Nope." "How are you feeling?" "Fine." They were the discoverers of the strain, and it seemed that they would have the chance to give it a name, provided they could isolate it, and provided it didn't isolate them first. Yarling went home for dinner with his family, but after he had read his children their stories and put them to bed, he returned to the institute and worked until late. The whole institute was lit up with activity, all the hot labs full of people and operating around the clock. Soon he had stripped nude in the locker room, and he was putting on his scrubs, and then he was wearing his spacesuit, feeling sleepy, warm, and full of dinner, as he faced the steel door blazed with the red flower, reluctant to take another step forward. He opened the door and went through to the hot side. He'd been testing his and Geisbert's blood all along, and he wondered if the virus would suddenly show up in it. He didn't think it was likely. I didn't stick the flask close to my nose. I kind of just waved my hand over it. They used to do that all the time in hospital labs with bacteria. It used to be standard procedure to sniff cultures in a lab. That was how you learned what bacteria smelled like. How you learned that some kinds smell like Welch's grape juice. The question of whether he, Peter Yarling, was infected with Ebola had become somewhat more pressing since the animal caretaker had puked on the lawn. That guy hadn't cut himself or stuck himself with a needle. Therefore, if that guy was breaking with Ebola, he might have caught it by breathing it in the air. Yarling carried some slides containing spots of his own blood serum into his closet, shut the door, turned out the light. He let his eyes adjust to the darkness and had the usual struggle to see anything in the microscope through his faceplate. Then the panorama swam into view. It was the ocean of his blood, stretching in all directions, grainy and mysterious, faintly glowing with green. This was a normal glow, nothing to get excited about, that faint green. If the green brightened into a hotter glow, that would signify that his blood was inhabited by Ebola. And what if his blood glowed? How would he judge if it was really glowing? How green is green? How much do I trust my tools and my perceptions? And if I'm convinced my blood is glowing, how am I going to report the results? I'll need to tell CJ. Maybe I won't have to go into the slammer. I could be biocontained right here in my own lab. I'm in biosafety level 4 right now. I'm already in isolation. Who can I infect here in my lab? Nobody. I could live and work in here if I go positive for Ebola. Nothing glowed. Nothing reacted to his blood. His blood was normal. Same with Tom Geisbert's blood. As to whether their blood would glow tomorrow or the next day or the day after that, only time would tell. But he and Geisbert were climbing out of the incubation period. At 11 o'clock at night, he decided it was time to go home, and he entered the airlock and pulled the chain to start the decon cycle. He was standing in gray light in the gray zone, alone with his thoughts. He couldn't see much of anything in here, in the chemical mist. He had to wait 7 minutes for the cycle to complete itself. His legs were killing him. He was so tired he couldn't stand up. He reached up with his hands and grabbed the pipes that fed chemicals into the shower to hold himself up. The warm liquid ran over his spacesuit. He felt comfortable and safe in here, surrounded by the sloshing noises of virus-killing liquids and the hiss of air and the ruffling sensation across his back as the chemicals played over his suit. He fell asleep. He jerked awake when the final blast of water jets hit him, and he found himself slumped against the wall of the airlock, his hands still gripped around the pipes. If it hadn't been for that last jet of water, he wouldn't have woken up. He would have slid down the wall and curled up in the corner of the airlock, and probably would have stayed there all night, sound asleep, while the cool, sterile air flowed through his suit and bathed his body, nude inside its cocoon at the heart of the Institute. Specialist Rhonda Williams was standing in the main corridor of the monkey house, afraid she would end up in the slammer. There was no sound except the roar of air in her helmet. The corridor stretched in both directions to infinity, strewn with cardboard boxes and trash and monkey biscuits. Where were the officers? Where was Colonel Jax? Where was everybody? She saw the doors leading to the monkey rooms. Maybe the officers were in there. Something was coming down the corridor. It was the loose monkey. He was running toward her. His eyes were staring at her. Something glittered in his hand. He was holding a syringe. He waved it at her with a gesture that conveyed passionate revenge. He wanted to give her an injection. The syringe was hot with an unknown agent. She started to run. Her spacesuit slowed her down. She kept running, but the hallway stretched on forever, and she couldn't reach the end. Where was the door out of here? There was no door. There was no way out. The monkey bounded toward her, its terrible eyes fixed on her, and the needle flashed and went into her suit. She woke up in her barracks room. Decon, December 7th, Thursday. Nancy Jax awoke at 4 o'clock in the morning to the sound of the telephone ringing. It was her brother, calling from a pay telephone at the hospital in Wichita. He said that their father was dying. "He's very, very bad, and he's not going to make it," he said. Their father was in cardiac failure, and the doctor had been asking if the family wanted him to undertake extreme life-saving measures. Nancy thought only briefly about this and told her brother not to do it. Her father was down to 90 pounds, just skin and bones, and he was in pain and miserable. She woke up Jerry and told him that her father would probably die today. She knew she would have to go home, but should she try to fly home today? She could arrive in Wichita by afternoon, and he might still be alive. She might be able to have a last farewell with him. She decided not to fly home. She felt that she couldn't leave her job in the middle of the Reston crisis, that it would be a dereliction of her post. The telephone rang again. It was Nancy's father calling from his hospital room. "Are you coming home, Nancy?" he asked. He sounded wheezy and faint. "I just can't get away right now, Dad. It's my work. I'm in the middle of a serious outbreak of disease." "I understand," he said. "I'll see you at Christmas, Dad." "I don't think I'll make it that long, but, well, you never know." "I'm sure you will make it." "I love you, Nancy." "I love you, too." In the blackness before dawn, she and Jerry got dressed, she in her uniform, he in civilian clothes, and he headed off for the monkey house. Nancy stayed at home until after the children had woken up, and she fixed them some cereal. She sent the children off on the school bus and drove to work. She went to Colonel C.J. Peters and told him that her father was probably going to die today. "Go home, Nancy," he said. "I'm not going to do that," she replied. The dead monkeys began coming in after lunch. A truck would bring them twice a day from Reston, and the first shipment would end up in Nancy's airlock while she was suiting up. Usually, there would be 10 or 12 monkeys in hat boxes. The rest of the monkeys that came out of the monkey house, the vast majority of them, 2 or 3 tons worth, were placed in triple biohazard bags, and the bags were decontaminated, taken out of the building, and placed in steel garbage cans. Hazleton employees then drove them to an incinerator owned by the company, where the monkeys were burned at a high temperature, high enough to guarantee the destruction of Ebola organisms. Some of the monkeys had to be examined, however, to see if and where the virus was spreading inside the building. Nancy would carry the hat boxes into Suite AA5 and work on the monkeys until after midnight with her partner and a civilian assistant. They hardly spoke to one another, except to point to a tool or to a sign of disease in a monkey. Thoughts about her father and her childhood came to Nancy that day. Years earlier, as a girl, she'd helped him during plowing season, driving his tractor from afternoon until late at night. Moving at a pace not much faster than a mule, it plowed furrows along a strip of land a half a mile long. She wore cut-off shorts and sandals. It was loud and hot on the tractor, and in the emptiness of Kansas she thought about nothing, drowned in the roar of the engine as the sun edged down to the horizon, and the land grew dark, and the moon appeared and climbed high. At 10 o'clock her father would take over and plow for the rest of the night, and she would go to bed. At sunrise he would wake her up, and she would get back on the tractor and keep on plowing. "Sponge," she mouthed to her buddy. He mopped up some blood from the monkey, and Nancy rinsed her gloves in the pan of green Envirochem. Her father died that day, while Nancy worked in the hot suite. She flew home to Kansas and arrived by taxi on Saturday morning at her family's plot at a graveyard in Wichita just as the funeral service began. It was a cold, rainy day, and a tiny knot of people holding umbrellas huddled around a preacher by a stone wall in a hole in the earth. Lieutenant Colonel Nancy Jacks moved forward to see more clearly, and her eyes rested on something that she hadn't quite anticipated. It was a flag draped over the casket. He had been a veteran, after all. The sight broke her down, and she burst into tears. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Thursday, December 7th, the last monkey was killed and bagged, and people began deconning out. They'd had a bad time trying to catch the little monkey that had escaped. It took hours. Jerry Jacks had entered the room where it was hiding and spent 2 or 3 hours chasing it in circles with a net. Finally, the monkey got itself jammed down in a crack behind a cage with its tail sticking out, and Sergeant Amon hit the tail with a massive dose of anesthetic. In about 15 minutes, the monkey became still, and they dragged it out, and it went the way of the other monkeys, carried along in the flow of material. They radioed Gene Johnson to tell him that the last monkey was dead. He told Sergeant Clagus to explore the building, to make sure that there were no more live monkeys in any rooms. Clagus discovered a chest freezer in a storage room. It looked sinister, and he radioed to Johnson. "Gene, I've got a freezer here." "Check it out," Johnson replied. Sergeant Clagus lifted the lid. He found himself staring into the eyes of frozen monkeys. They were sitting in clear plastic bags, their bodies streamed with blood icicles. They were monkeys from Room F, the original hot spot of the outbreak, some of the monkeys that had been sacrificed by Dan Dalgard. He shut the lid and called Johnson on the radio. "Gene, you're not going to believe what I've found in this freezer. I've got 10 or 15 monkeys." "Ah, shit, Clagus. What should I do with them?" "I don't want any more problems with monkeys. No more samples. Decon them."
I also found some vials of sedative. Decon it, baby. You don't know if any dirty needles have been stuck in those bottles. Everything comes out of this building. Everything comes out.
Sergeant Clagus and a civilian, Merrill Gibson, dragged the bags out of the freezer. They tried to cram the monkeys into hat boxes, but they didn't fit. They were twisted into bizarre shapes. They left them in the hallway to thaw. The decon teams would deal with them tomorrow. The 91 Tangos shuffled out through the airlock corridor. Two by two, numb and tired beyond feeling, soaked with sweat and continual fear. They had collected a total of 3,500 clinical samples. They didn't want to talk about the operation with each other or with their officers. When the team members left for Fort Detrick, they noticed that Gene Johnson was sitting on the grass under the tree in front of the building. He didn't want to talk to anyone, and they were afraid to talk to him. He looked terrible. His mind was a million miles away, in the devastated zone inside the building. He kept going over and over what the kids had done. If the guy has the needle in his right hand, you stand on his left. You pin the monkey's arms behind so it can't turn around and bite you. Did anyone cut a finger? So far, it looked as if all the kids had made it. The decon team suited up immediately while the soldiers were coming out of the building. It was now after dark, but Gene Johnson feared Ebola so much that he didn't want to let the building sit untouched overnight. The decon team was led by Merrill Gibson. He put on a space suit and explored the building to get a sense of what needed to be done. The rooms and halls were blood-stained and strewn with medical packaging. Monkey biscuits lay everywhere and crunched underfoot. Monkey feces lay in loops on the floor and was squiggled in lines across the walls and printed in the shapes of small hands. He had a brush and a bucket of bleach, and he tried to scrub a wall. Then he called Gene on the radio. "Gene, the shit in here is like cement. It won't come off."
"You do what's best. Our orders are to clean this place up."
"We'll try to chip it off," Gibson said.
The next day, they went to a hardware store and bought putty knives and steel spatulas, and the decon team went to work chipping the walls and floor. They almost suffocated from the heat inside their suits. Milton Frantig, the man who had thrown up on the lawn, had now been kept in isolation at Fairfax Hospital for several days. He was feeling much better. His fever had vanished. He hadn't developed any nosebleeds, and he was getting restless. Apparently, he did not have Ebola. At any rate, it didn't show up in his blood tests. Apparently, he had a mild case of flu. The CDC eventually told him he could go home. By day 19 after the whiffing incident, when they hadn't had any bloody noses, Peter Yarling and Tom Geisbert began to regard themselves as definite survivors. The fact that Dan Dalgard and the monkey workers had so far shown no signs of breaking with Ebola also reassured them, although it was very puzzling. What on earth was going on with this virus? It killed monkeys like flies. They were dripping virus from every pore, yet no human being had crashed. If the virus wasn't Ebola, Zaire, what was it? And where had it come from? Yarling believed that it must have come from Africa. After all, Nurse Mayinga's blood reacted to it. Therefore, it must be closely related to Ebola Zaire. It was behaving like the fictional Andromeda strain. Just when we thought the world was coming to an end, the virus slipped away, and we survived. The Centers for Disease Control focused its efforts on trying to trace the source of the virus, and the trail eventually led back to the Fairlight Farm's monkey storage facility near Manila. All of the Reston monkeys had come from there. The place was a way station on their trip from the forests of Mindanao to Washington. Investigators found that the monkeys had been dying in large numbers there, too. But it looked as though no Philippine monkey workers had become sick either. If it was an African virus, What was it doing in the Philippines? And why weren't monkey handlers dying? Yet the virus was able to destroy a monkey. Something very strange was going on here. Nature had seemed to be closing in on us for a kill when she suddenly turned her face away and smiled. It was a Mona Lisa smile, the meaning of which no one could figure out. December 18th, Monday. The decon team scrubbed the building with bleach until they took the paint off the concrete floors, and still they kept scrubbing. When they were satisfied that all of the building's inside surfaces had been scoured, they moved on to the final stage, the gas. The decon team taped the exterior doors, windows, and vents of the building with silver duct tape. They taped sheets of plastic over the exterior openings of the ventilation system. They made the building airtight. At various places inside the monkey house, they set out patches of paper saturated with spores of a harmless bacterium known as Bacillus subtilis niger. These spores are hard to kill. It is believed that a decon job that kills niger will kill almost anything. The decon team brought 39 Sunbeam electric frying pans to the monkey house. Sunbeam electric frying pans are the Army's tool of choice for a decon job. The team laid an electric cable along the floor throughout the building, strung with outlets, like a cord for Christmas tree lights. At points along the cable, they plugged in the Sunbeam frying pans. They wired the cable to a master switch. Into each Sunbeam frying pan, they dropped a handful of disinfecting crystals. The crystals were white and resembled salt. They dialed the pans to high. At 1800 hours on December 18th, someone threw the master switch, and the sunbeams began to cook. The crystals boiled away, releasing formaldehyde gas. Since the building's doors, windows, and vents were taped shut, the gas had nowhere to go, and it stayed inside the building for 3 days. The gas penetrated the air ducts, soaked the offices, got into drawers in the desks, and got inside pencil sharpeners in the drawers. It infiltrated Xerox machines and worked its way inside personal computers and inside the cushions of chairs and fingered down into the floor drains until it touched pools of lingering bleach in the water traps. Finally, the decon team, still wearing spacesuits, went back inside the building and collected the spore samples. The sunbeam treatment had killed the niger. There's an old piece of wisdom in biohazard work that goes like this. You can never know when life is exterminated. Life will survive almost any blitz. Total, unequivocal sterilization is extremely difficult to achieve in practice and is almost impossible to verify afterward. However, a sunbeam cookout that lasts for 3 days and exterminates all samples of niger implies success. The monkey house had been sterilized. Ebola had met opposition. For a short while, until life could reestablish itself there, the Reston Primate Quarantine Unit was the only building in the world where nothing lived. Nothing at all. The Most Dangerous Strain, 1990, January. The strain of Ebola virus that had erupted near Washington went into hiding somewhere in the rainforest. The cycling went on. The cycling must always go on if the virus is to maintain its existence. The Army, having certified that the monkey house had been nuked, returned it to the possession of Hazelton Research Products. Hazelton began buying more monkeys from the Philippines, from the same monkey house near Manila, and restocked the building with crab-eating monkeys that had been trapped in the rainforests of Mindanao. Less than a month later, in the middle of January, some of the monkeys in Room C began dying with bloody noses. Dan Dalgard called Peter Yarling. "Looks like we're affected again," he said. The virus was Ebola. It had come from the Philippines. This time, Since there'd been no human casualties during the first outbreak, the Army, the CDC, and Hazelton jointly decided to isolate the monkeys, leave them alone, and let the virus burn. Dan Dalgard hoped to save at least some of the monkeys, and his company didn't want the Army to come back with spacesuits. What happened in that building was a kind of experiment. Now they would see what Ebola could do naturally in a population of monkeys living in a confined airspace, in a kind of city, as it were. The Ebola Restin virus jumped quickly from room to room, and as it blossomed in the monkeys, it seemed to mutate spontaneously into something that looked quite a lot like the common cold. But it was an Ebola cold. The monkeys died with great quantities of clear mucus and green mucus running from their noses, mixed with blood that would not clot. Their lungs were destroyed, rotten and swimming with Ebola virus. They had pneumonia. When a single animal with a nosebleed showed up in a room, generally 80% of the animals died in that room shortly afterward. The virus was extraordinarily infective in monkeys. The Institute scientists suspected that they were seeing a mutant strain of Ebola, something new and a little different from what they had seen just a month before in December when the Army had nuked the monkey house. It was frightening. It was as if Ebola could change its character fast, as if a different strain could appear in a month's time. The clinical symptoms of the disease served as a reminder of the fact that Ebola is related to certain kinds of colds seen in human children. It seemed that the virus could adapt quickly to new hosts and that it could change its character rapidly as it entered a new population. Ebola apparently drifted through the building's air handling ducts. By January 24th, it had entered room B, and monkeys in that room started going into shock and dying with runny noses, red eyes, and mask-like expressions on their faces. In the following weeks, the infection entered rooms I, F, E, and D, and the animals in these rooms virtually all died. Then in mid-February, a Hazelton animal caretaker, who will be called John Coleus, was performing a necropsy on a dead monkey when he cut his thumb with a scalpel. He'd been slicing apart the liver, one of the favorite nesting sites of Ebola. The scalpel blade, smeared with liver cells and blood, went deep into his thumb. He'd had a major exposure to Ebola. The liver that he had been cutting was rushed to USAMRID for analysis. Tom Geispert looked at a piece of it under his microscope and to his dismay found that it was incredibly hot. I mean, wall to wall with virus. Everyone at the Institute thought John Coleus was going to die. Around here, Peter Yarling told me, we were frankly fearful that this guy had bought the farm. The CDC decided not to put him into isolation, so Coleus visited bars and drank beer with his friends. Here at the Institute, Peter Yarling said, we were absolutely appalled when that guy went out to bars drinking. Clearly, the CDC shouldn't have let that happen. This was a serious virus in a serious situation. We don't know a whole lot about the virus. It could be like the common cold. It could have a latency period when you're shedding virus before you develop symptoms. And by the time you know you're sick, you might have infected 16 people. There's an awful lot we don't know about this virus. We don't know where it came from, and we don't know what form it will take when it appears next time. John Coleus had a minor medical condition that required surgery. Doctors performed the operation while he was in the incubation period after his exposure to Ebola. There's no record indicating that he bled excessively during the surgery. He came through fine, and he's alive today, with no ill effects from his exposure. As for the monkey house, the entire building died. The Army didn't have to nuke it. It was nuked by the Ebola Restin virus. Once again, there were no human casualties. However, something eerie and perhaps sinister occurred. A total of 4 men had worked as caretakers in the monkey house. Jarvis Purdy, who had had a heart attack. Milton Frantig, who had thrown up on the lawn. John Coleus, who had cut his thumb, and a fourth man. All four men eventually tested positive for Ebola-Reston virus. They had all been infected with the agent. The virus had entered their bloodstreams and multiplied in their cells. Ebola proliferated in their bodies. It cycled in them. It carried on its life inside the monkey workers. But it didn't make them sick, even while it multiplied inside them. If they had headaches or felt ill, none of them could recall it. Eventually, the virus cleared from their systems naturally, disappeared from their blood. And as of this writing, none of the men was affected by it. They are among the very, very few human survivors of Ebola virus. John Colius certainly caught the virus when he cut himself with a bloody scalpel, no question about that. What's more worrisome is that the others had not cut themselves, yet the virus entered their bloodstreams. It got there somehow. Most likely it entered their blood through contact with the lungs. It infected them through the air. When it became apparent to the Army researchers that three of the four men who became infected had not cut themselves, just about everyone at USAMRID concluded that Ebola can spread through the air. Dr. Philip Russell, the general who made the decision to send in the Army to stop the virus, recently said to me that although he had been scared to death about Ebola at the time, it wasn't until afterward, when he understood that the virus was spreading in the air among the monkeys, that the true potential for disaster sank in for him. "I was more frightened in retrospect," he said. "When I saw the respiratory evidence coming from those monkeys, I said to myself, 'My God, with certain kinds of small changes, this virus could become one that travels in rapid respiratory transmission through humans.' I'm talking about the Black Death. Imagine a virus with the infectiousness of influenza and the mortality rate of the Black Plague in the Middle Ages. That's what we're talking about." The workers at Reston had had symptomless Ebola virus. Why didn't it kill them? To this day, no one knows the answer to that question. Symptomless Ebola. The men had been infected with something like an Ebola cold. A tiny difference in the virus's genetic code, probably resulting in a small structural change in the shape of one of the seven mysterious proteins in the virus particle, had apparently changed its effects tremendously in humans, rendering it mild or harmless, even though it had destroyed the monkeys. This strain of Ebola knew the difference between a monkey and a person. And if it should mutate in some other direction. One day in spring, I went to visit Colonel Nancy Jacks to interview her about her work during the Reston event. We talked in her office. She wore a black military sweater with silver eagles on the shoulder boards. She had recently made full colonel. A baby parrot slept in a box in the corner. The parrot woke up and squeaked. "Are you hungry?" she asked it. "Yeah, yeah, I know." She pulled a turkey baster out of a bag and loaded it with parrot mush. She stuck the baster into the parrot's beak and squeezed the baster bulb, and the parrot closed its eyes with satisfaction. She waved her hand at some filing cabinets. "Want to look at some Ebola? Take your pick." "You show me." She searched through a cabinet and removed a handful of glass slides and carried them into another room where a microscope sat on a table. It had two sets of eyepieces so that two people could look into it at the same time. I sat down and stared into the microscope, into white nothingness. "Okay, here's a good one," she said, and placed a slide under the lens. I saw a field of cells. Here and there, pockets of cells had burst and liquefied. "That's male reproductive tissue," she said. "It's heavily infected. This is Ebola Zaire in a monkey that was exposed through the lungs in 1986 in the study that Gene Johnson and I did." Looking at the slice of monkey testicle, I got an unpleasant sensation. "You mean it got into the monkey's lungs and moved to its..." "Yeah, it's pretty yucky," she said. Now I'm going to make you dizzy. I'm going to show you the lung. The scene shifted, and we were looking at rotted pink Belgian lace. This is a slice of lung tissue, a monkey that was exposed through the lungs. See how the virus bubbles up in the lung? It's Ebola, Zaire. I could see individual cells, and some of them were swollen with dark specks. We'll go to higher magnification. The cells got bigger. The dark specks became angular, shadowy blobs. The blobs were bursting out of the cells like something hatching. Those are big, fat bricks, she said. They were Ebola crystalloids bursting out of the lungs. The lungs were popping Ebola directly into the air. My scalp crawled, and I felt suddenly like a civilian who had seen something that maybe civilians shouldn't see. These lungs are very hot, she said in a matter-of-fact voice. You see those bricks budding directly into the air spaces of the lung? When you cough, this stuff comes up your throat in your sputum. That's why you don't want someone who has Ebola coughing in your face. My God, it knows all about lungs, doesn't it? Maybe not. It might live in an insect, and insects don't have lungs. But you see here how Ebola has adapted to this lung. It's budding out of the lung, right straight into the air. We're looking at a highly sophisticated organism, aren't we? You're absolutely right. This Hummer has an established life cycle. You get into that what-if game? What if it got into human lungs? If it mutates, it could be a problem. A big problem. In March 1990, while the second outbreak at Reston was happening, the CDC slapped a heavy set of restrictions on monkey importers, tightening the testing and quarantine procedures. The CDC also temporarily revoked the licenses of three companies, Hazelton Research Products, the Charles River Primates Corporation, and Worldwide Primates, charging these companies with violations of quarantine rules. Their licenses were later reinstated. The CDC's actions effectively stopped the importation of monkeys into the United States for several months. The total loss to Hazelton ran into the millions of dollars. Monkeys are worth money. Despite the CDC's action against Hazelton, scientists at USAMRID and even some at the CDC gave Dalgard and his company high praise for making the decision to hand over the monkey facility to the Army. It was hard for Hazelton, but they did the right thing, Peter Yarling said to me, summing up the general opinion of the experts. Hazelton had been renting the monkey house from a commercial landlord. Not surprisingly, relations between the landlord and Hazelton didn't flourish happily during the Army operation and the second Ebola outbreak. The company vacated the building afterward, and to this day it stands empty. Peter Yarling, a whiffer of Ebola who lived to tell about it, is now the principal scientist at USAMRID. He and Tom Geispert, following tradition in the naming of new viruses, named the strain they had discovered Reston, after the place where it was first noticed. In conversation, they sometimes refer to it casually as Ebola Reston. One day in his office, Yarling showed me a photograph of some Ebola virus particles. They resembled noodles that had been cooked al dente. Look at this honker. Look at this long sucker here, Yarling said, his finger tracing a loop. It's Reston. Oh, I was about to say it's Reston, but it isn't. It's Zaire. The point is, you can't easily tell the difference between the two strains by looking. It brings you back to a philosophical question. Why is the Zaire stuff hot for humans? Why isn't Reston hot for humans when the strains are so close to each other? The Ebola Reston virus is almost certainly transmitted by some airborne route. Those Hazelton workers who had the virus, I'm pretty sure they got it through the air. Did we dodge a bullet? I don't think we did, Yarling said. The bullet hit us. We were just lucky that the bullet we took was a rubber bullet from a .22, rather than a dum-dum bullet from a .45. My concern is that people are saying, "Phew, we dodged a bullet." And the next time they see Ebola in a microscope, they'll say, "Ah, it's just restin'," and they'll take it outside a containment facility. And we'll get whacked in the forehead when the stuff turns out not to be restin', but its big sister. C.J. Peters eventually left the Army to become chief of the Special Pathogens Branch at the Centers for Disease Control. Looking back on the Reston event, he said to me one day that he was pretty sure Ebola had spread through the air. "I think the pattern of spread that we saw and the fact that it spread to new rooms suggests that Ebola aerosols were being generated and were present in the building," he said. "If you look at pictures of lungs from a monkey with Ebola Zaire, you see that the lungs are fogged with Ebola. Have you seen those pictures?" "Yes, Nancy Jacks showed them to me." "Then you know. You can see Ebola particles clearly in the air spaces of the lung. Did you ever try to see if you could put Ebola restin into the air and spread it among monkeys that way?" I asked. "No," he replied firmly. "I just didn't think that was a good idea. If anybody found out that the Army was doing experiments to see if the Ebola virus had adapted to spreading in the respiratory tract, we would have been accused of doing offensive biological warfare, trying to create a doomsday germ. So we elected not to follow it up." "That means you don't really know if Ebola spreads in the air." "That's right. We don't know. You have to wonder if Ebola virus can do that or not. If it can, that's about the worst thing you can imagine." So the three sisters, Marburg, Ebola Sudan, and Ebola Zaire, have been joined by a fourth sister, Reston. A group of researchers at the Special Pathogens Branch of the CDC, principally Anthony Sanchez and Heinz Feldman, have picked apart the genes of all the filoviruses. They've discovered that Zaire and Reston are so much alike that it's hard to say how they're different. When I met Anthony Sanchez and asked him about it, he said to me, "I call them kissing cousins, but I can't put my finger on why Reston apparently doesn't make us sick. Personally, I wouldn't feel comfortable handling it without a suit and maximum containment procedures." Each virus contains 7 proteins, 4 of which are completely unknown. Something slightly different about one of the Reston proteins is probably the reason the virus didn't go off in Washington like a bonfire. The Army and the CDC have never downgraded the safety status of Reston virus. It remains classified as a level 4 hot agent, and if you want to shake hands with it, you had better be wearing a spacesuit. Safety experts feel that there isn't enough evidence yet to show that the Reston strain is not an extremely dangerous virus. It may be, in fact, the most dangerous of all the filovirus sisters because of its seeming ability to travel rather easily through the air, perhaps more easily than the others. A tiny change in its genetic code, and it might turn into a cough and take out the human race. Why is the Reston virus so much like Ebola Zaire when Reston supposedly comes from Asia? If the strains come from different continents, they should be quite different from each other. One possibility is that the Reston strain originated in Africa and flew to the Philippines on an airplane not long ago. In other words, Ebola has already entered the net and has been traveling lately. The experts don't doubt that a virus can hop around the world in a matter of days. Perhaps Ebola came out of Africa and landed in Asia a few years back. Perhaps, this is only a guess, Ebola traveled to Asia inside wild African animals. There have been rumors that wealthy people in the Philippines who own private estates in the rainforest have been importing African animals illegally, releasing them into the Philippine jungle and hunting them. If Ebola lives in African game animals, in leopards or lions or in Cape buffalo, it might have traveled to the Philippines that way. This is only a guess. Like all the other thread viruses, Ebola Reston hides in a secret place. It seems quite likely, however, that the entire Reston outbreak started with a single monkey in the Philippines. One sick monkey. That monkey was the unknown index case. One monkey started the whole thing. That monkey, perhaps, picked up 4 or 5 particles of Ebola that came from... anyone's guess. Part 4. Kitum Cave. Highway, 1993, August. The road to Mount Elgon heads northwest from Nairobi into the Kenya highlands, climbing through green hills that bump against African skies. It goes through small farms and patches of cedar forest, and then it breaks over a crest of land and seems to leap out into space, into a bowl of yellow haze, which is the Rift Valley. The road descends into the rift, cutting across wrinkled knees of bluffs, until it hits bottom and unravels on a savanna dotted with acacia trees. It skirts the lakes at the bottom of the rift and passes through groves of fever trees, yellow-green and glowing in the sun. It's detained in cities that dwell by the lakes, and then it turns westward toward a line of blue hills, which is the western side of the rift, and it climbs into the hills, a straight, narrow, paved 2-lane highway, crowded with smoky overlander trucks gasping up the grade, bound for Uganda and Zaire. The road to Mount Elgon is a segment of the AIDS Highway, the Kinshasa Highway, the road that cuts Africa in half, along which the AIDS virus traveled during its breakout from somewhere in the African rainforest to every place on Earth. The road was once a dirt track that wandered through the heart of Africa, almost impossible to traverse along its complete length. Long sections of it were paved in the 1970s, and the trucks began rolling through, and soon afterward, the AIDS virus appeared in towns along the highway. Exactly where the virus came from is one of the great mysteries. The road to Mount Elgon was familiar to me. I had traveled over it as a boy. My parents and my brothers and I had lived for a while with a Luo family on their farm in the hills overlooking Lake Victoria, a traditional farm with mud huts and a boma for keeping cattle. I hadn't been back to Africa since I was 12 years old, but when you've encountered Africa in childhood, it becomes a section of your mind. I had felt warm river sand on my bare feet and had smelled crocodiles. I knew the crispy sensation of tsetse flies crawling in my hair. I could still hear the sound of voices speaking English in the soft accents of the Luo language, urging me to feel free, eat more fat from the ram's tail. I knew what it felt like to wake up in gray light before dawn, not knowing where I was, seeing a mud wall with a hole in it, and gradually realizing that the hole was a window in a hut, and that I was being watched through the window by a crowd of children. When I saw Africa again, Africa came back whole, alive, shining with remembered enigma. What came back first was the smell of Africa, the smoky smell of cooking fires, which produce a haze of burning acacia and blue gum wood that covers the towns and clings to the bodies of people. What came back to me next, with a slap of recognition, was the sight of crowds of people walking along the roads, as if they had been walking since the beginning of time, heading nowhere and everywhere by foot. In the highlands of Kenya, their bare and sandaled feet pound the shoulders of the highway into braids of red clay. The women sing Christian hymns as they walk, and some carry guitars, or they carry sacks of charcoal or salt balanced on their heads. The Land Rover smashed through a pall of diesel smoke,
and bounced as it hit a pothole. Robin MacDonald, my guide, gripped the steering wheel.
"Oh, this road is good, man," he said approvingly.